I took automatic vape pen filling machines and I put them into manual fill mode. I filled one pen and then they passed it to the next person. They filled one pen, they passed it to the next person. We had no errors during that process because you physically watch each individual one get filled. And we went from doing daily production of maybe 2,000 vapes to 40,000.
Welcome to the Diamond Miners Podcast. A podcast for cannabis operators by cannabis operators. My name's Benjamin Ballinger, and I'm on a mission to explore what makes great cannabis companies great. I talk with real operators across the US and beyond who are making moves in their markets to find out how they're creating successful organizations that can withstand the test of time in this volatile world that we all know as the cannabis industry.
What's up, everyone? This is your host, Benjamin Ballinger, and welcome to episode number 10 of the Diamond Miners Podcast. In today's episode, I had a chance to chat with Grant Schuster, the CEO of Accelerant Manufacturing out of Miami Beach, Florida. And Grant originally cut his teeth in cannabis as the first ever hired employee of the Maryland-based operator Curio Wellness, where he eventually went on to lead their manufacturing and supply chain efforts. And he then went on to Parallel, headquartered out of Atlanta, Georgia, and he headed up a turnaround effort for one of their main manufacturing sites before he went on to co-found his own company, Accelerant. We talked about the unique approach his new company takes to co-production with a business model he calls PAAS, or Production as a Service, as well as his plans to launch his own innovative pre-roll brand here in the Illinois market. We also got to speak quite a bit about lean manufacturing, given this is one of Grant's main areas of expertise. Now, before we get into today's episode, I just want to remind you all to subscribe to the podcast and to check out our website at diamondminers.co for free articles and downloadable tools designed to help you grow your cannabis company. All right, that's enough blabbing from me. Let's get into it. Grant, my man, what's going on?
How you doing? Good to see you again.
Good to see you again, too. It's been a long time. Keep trying to catch each other, and you know, it's like I think we're both at Benzinga, right? But it's one of those things where you've got 100 people that you need to see and you only got time to see 20, and totally every time I overestimate my ability to connect with everybody. So
And we live so close together, you would think it would happen more often, but you know,
you get that local
reality happens.
Yeah, so I'm super excited to chat today, and I know you got a lot of really cool things going on, and getting ready to dig into all that. Before we get into too much of that, why don't you just give the listeners a little bit of a background of yourself, you know, what brought you into the industry and kind of what brought you to where you are today?
Yeah, you know, I have sort of a interesting background. I was in herbs and spices. My career before cannabis was really herbs and spices, very similar to cannabis, right? All natural products. We imported them from all over the world. And then you would buy them in the store unbeknownst to you. So boar's head meats or Sweet Baby Ray's barbecue sauce. And the way that industry works is much more siloed today. I imagine in the past, in 50, 100 years ago, maybe not so much. But the commercial side of it, you have people who are really good at certain things. So that's what I did prior. And it was really all about lean manufacturing. How do we make products or manufacture for these other manufacturers based on certain criteria, right? You had, had to be GMO free or allergen specific, or how to make stuff on time for them, right? Because at the end of the day, you go to the grocery store, the thing you hate is, you know, there's no more jerk chicken, and that's the thing you really wanted today. So
every day, man, always want that.
Or even chicken. Worse, you go to buy the jerk chicken, it tastes different, right?
Yeah.
And there's a lot out of your control. So that industry really gave me a background. I mean, when you start milling spices and then you blending them and then getting into cannabis, you can look backward and say, wow, that process was pretty similar. But that's kind of how I started. How I got into cannabis was a cold email I wrote to a serial entrepreneur in Maryland who I found out was applying for or wanted to apply for a license. So I wrote an email. I'm like, I don't know, other than smoking a ton of pot in college, I don't know the first thing about a cannabis business, but I know business, and I you know, smoke some pot. So I think I'll be a good candidate for you. And he probably, maybe against better judgment, gave me a chance, but it actually worked out. We're still very close today. Curio Wellness is a great company out of Maryland. They're expanding to Missouri. And that was how I first jumped in. You know, 2015, we were an idea. You know, him and his daughter had this idea. We're going to start a cannabis company. And, you know, if you haven't met Michael, he's a very serious entrepreneur. And you probably wouldn't have expected him to go in this industry. But he vetted if it's real or if it's fake. And at the time, very medical focus, I think now is more on holistic, right? As a lot of companies shifted. So that's how we got in, wrote the application, found people, figured out, you know, which way was up and which way was down. We raised capital together, and it was a great, great learning experience. I would call that my single state operator life. Then my wife dragged me down to Florida, and which was great. And I did a manufacturing turnaround of a MSO. So that was also a very interesting experience. You know, I kind of got the single state operator, the multi-state operator experience before starting my own business, which I help support those companies today. So that's really what we do.
Tell me a little bit about this MSO turnaround. I mean, I don't know if you can talk about who it was with, but at least let's talk about what that involved. What was the state of the business prior, and then what did you do?
Yes. Yeah, so, you know, when I first took over the operations at that time, I think it was like 18, 19, right? Or I guess really focused on 19. A lot of MSOs were rapidly scaling. And so they were bringing on staff and doing so many different projects at a time. And as a result, the focus on the existing operation and is not as probably top of mind as the growth opportunity, right? The CEOs of these public companies get graded on, you know, revenue growth quarter over quarter, right? It's less so about, you know, hey, did we make 15,006 vapes today, which was the demand. So I was lucky to join. I really actually joined for process improvement for lean across the enterprise. But the gentleman that was running manufacturing in Florida moved to doing commercialization of new products, and it left a void. So at the time, there was, you know, I think we were at 34 stores, maybe some more. And, you know, there are certain products that are challenging to make. We made soft gels, which are a technical product, and had a tremendously difficult time manufacturing them. And then we were really falling behind on manufacturing different products. So the first hallmark is just getting stock, right? An ism from, I brought up Michael Braunfein before. His ism is you can't sell from an empty wagon. And that's true. So the company we were with had a really great supply chain team that had done a lot of work on figuring out what they thought demand was for different SKUs. And that gives me the operator tack time, which is critical to sizing of production lines and you know, workflows and staffing. And so once I figured out with them how much we need to make and by when, actually the back end is kind of easier, right? You know what you have to do, how you have to do it, when you have to do it by. The biggest challenge really comes when you lack technical skill. I would say I understand a lot of technicalities, but I'm not a technical expert on everything. I mean, I think that's a challenge in cannabis, as I know you've come into contact with. So for soft gel, we brought in consultants that I had used in the past from the pharmaceutical world, because it really was a pharmaceutical type product. And we could have spent 6 or 12 months trying to figure it out, or we could spend 3 weeks and get it on the shelves and then use that new opportunity to really start saying, okay, how do we make more soft gels, different soft gels, other different things? So that's really kind of what the first task was, get in stock, because marketing said if they're in stock, they're going to sell. They did sell more than they were when they weren't in stock, but probably not as much as they thought they would sell when they were fully in stock. So over the course of about 12 months, we went from about 50-60% in stock to about 98%. And that's really lean manufacturing. It's really how to focus.
Yeah, one of the reasons I was so excited to chat with you is because I think when it comes to lean and, you know, Six Sigma and stuff, I think you have a bit more of a grasp of that than myself, for sure, and probably a lot of other people. So it's nice to be able to dig into some of the specifics. I know you mentioned Tact Time. Do you want to talk a little bit about kind of how that specifically was relevant in relation with some of the demand projections and kind of how you were able to align those two things, the production and the demand?
Absolutely. So Tact Time is how fast you need to make a product. So, I need to make a vape pen every 10 seconds, right? It has to come off the line every 10 seconds. How I get there, varies, right? Staffing, workflows, process points. But once you know how fast you need to go, you can really tailor everything behind it. Like, if you ask me, in cannabis, two things people should focus on is what's your tact time and single piece flow. There's a lot of equipment in the ether and in the cannabis industry that is automated. And this was probably the biggest impact to us hitting our demand. Was I took automatic vape pen filling machines and I put them into manual fill mode. I filled one pen and then they passed it to the next person. They filled one pen, they passed it to the next person. We had no errors during that process because you physically watch each individual one get filled. And we went from doing daily production of maybe 2,000 vapes to 40,000, right? And it's sort of a battling paradox, right? You think automated and you always think it's faster. But the setup these machines required, the error checking they required, it took too much. And in the 25 minutes it took for them to get these things calibrated, I could be producing more product. So it was really about tact time, how fast do I need to produce to demand? And then single piece flow, make one unit at a time and keep producing. So that's this. If you ask me for lean, two pieces of advice, that's what it'd be. If you ask me for a third piece of advice, I would say there are a very small number of very, very good lean consultancies in the world, in my opinion, and some of which will back their success. They'll say, if we're unsuccessful, we'll pay you back. We won't take the fees. And I think that in an industry like this, that's really a good investment. And from a positive ROI, we worked on product. Everyone says lean doesn't apply to growing plants. Lean doesn't apply to weed, right? Like, lean is creating value, maintaining value and quality, safety, quality, delivery, cost, right? In that order. If you can't do it safe, don't do it, right?
Yep.
Quality, if you don't make a good unit,
don't eliminate things at the expense of quality. You got to keep the quality there as you remove the waste.
Yeah. And luckily we're in an industry of high margins in most jurisdictions, right? And eventually I think that will come back. And so for cost, I think you have to always be aware of it, right? You can't lose money on every sale because then you're not a business.
You got to tell about 75 to 80% of the cannabis companies that little thing there. I don't know that everybody knows that. Just sell more, dude. Just sell more.
Yeah, it's interesting, right? But so you have some latitude, I think, to figure out, how to invest into the right thing, really focus and make a great product. So to your point on lean, I think it's a great set of skills. I think everybody who we worked with, you get to do fun projects. There's moonshining, as people will call it, where you kind of try something out. Maybe you wouldn't do it like that normally, but you're just trying to see if it will work.
Yeah.
It's really guided, I think, the success of the companies and the efforts that we had.
It's funny when you're talking about single piece flow, because I think that's one area that so many people love the term lean, right? And they throw it around a lot. And I think that's why there's so few good lean consultants, because they don't really know the concepts that well. Like we hear all right, pull inventory. So then people apply that to the raw materials and they apply, you know, up and down the chain, not realizing that what inventory management is really about in lean is keeping the WIP product, the work in process, as limited as possible. One of the main ways of doing that is making the batches as small as possible, right? Which is kind of what Toyota was all about when they pretty much invented it, was instead of doing the Henry Ford mass production model, they said, all right, well, we have a lot of variety. We're not just going to have one color and one model, and we're going to produce a million of them. And, you know, I think the famous quote is, you can have any color you want as long as it's black, right?
Yeah.
That was the Ford way, right? And then Toyota's like, well, we don't have that kind of demand here, so we need to be able to cater to all the different varieties, but we also want to be able to maintain the efficiencies that mass production provided. And that's where lean comes in, because it allows you to maintain or even increase in many ways, like you said, right? The throughput, while still having the ability to control quality much better, to have the variety that you need by limiting the setup times and all that stuff. I know one of the other things you're working on outside of the operations is your equipment and financing company. And so I definitely want to talk about that too, because I believe you have been designing your equipment with this type of stuff in mind. And I'd love to hear about that, because like you said, the vast majority of automated equipment does so in biggest batches possible, right? Like vape filling machines, usually 100, 200, whatever it is.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, you were talking and it reminded me really of kind of how we got started, right? The knock box, fill 100 at a time. It does 102 minutes, kind of, right? You know, but they're not all weighed, and there's all this excess material, which joint came from what. And so our equipment really focuses on two things, single piece flow manufacturing, right? Make one joint at a time. And so our systems are completely asynchronous. And we have some new exciting new technology, all based on consumer demand. The other thing I'll talk about afterwards is supermarkets and how people can use them. But with single piece flow, you know, we really focus each machine. We have a 2-up and a 4-up machine. And what I mean by an up is you can make one at a time with a 1-up, 2 at a time with a 2-up, and then 4 at a time with a 4-up machine. But each one of those processes is unique to that group. And so we're following the same practices of single piece flow, but we're doing them 4 at a time. Mm. But the weighing for group one is for the group one's joints and the compaction. And so all the settings associated with them are tied together.
Can I jump in for a second? Cause I want to help. I feel like some of the listeners might lose sight of what we're talking about here. So let's pull this back to a very easy to understand process that has no equipment at all. Let's talk about a team. Let's say it's a 5-step process. We've got 5 people, right? One team, right? And they're doing a single flow. So the first person takes the vape cart, right? They put it in the filler. They fill it, they hand it to the next person caps it, they hand it to the next person puts it in a box, hand it to the next person puts a label on it. Well, let's just say it's 4 steps because I can't think of one after that. But so we got 4 steps from start to finish. Everyone's doing one thing. They're not doing 1,000 of them at a time and then moving to the next step and then capping all of them at the time and all that. Now, what you're saying with a 2-up would be like, if instead of that same, you know, Harry's number one in line, he's not taking 2 carts and doing it. It'd be like if Harry was leading one 4-person team and you said, all right, Sally, you're leading another 4-person team. You guys are going to both do one piece at a time. Is that correct?
Yes and no. I think, you know, for example, if he had 2 filling heads, he could fill 2 at a time and pass 2, right? Where that challenge would come in, right? What people don't realize is, there's a few different types of WIP. There's sort of WIP in your vault, right? That people look at and they say, I got 10,000 grams of oil. And then there's in-process WIP. So what we found is that there was so much WIP in between the filler and the capper, right? That it didn't work. And so—
Which is a big area of failure with vape carts, because you have a limited time to cap those things, right?
Huge area of failure. You know, and also it's hard to look at 100 and go, yes, they're all filled exactly right. You know, when you fill one, here's really the truth about single piece flow and why it works. you build quality into the process. If I'm looking at just this pen and I, you know, not here, and it's blue and I put the cap on, right? If I do that, I know it's not sealed because it's the only thing I'm focused on. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so that's really sort of the secret, is you start to build quality in and you have much, much fewer defects, which means you're really producing. So there are
no empty pre-roll tubes that don't have a joint in them.
Absolutely not. There are definitely processes where you can do two of something at a time and it doesn't impact. And you know, in generality, your reference point is really right. You do one thing and you pass it to the next person who does one thing. And when you think about capping, right, if you can reach with your left hand and grab a cap while you get the vape pen from your partner with your right, right, that motion is very easy for a person, right? There's ergonomics involved. And so they're kind of doing everything at the same time, right?
Yeah, it's efficient.
It's efficient ergonomically. It's more comfortable, which is a whole nother. I mean, to talk about pre-rolls, the ergonomics of making pre-rolls is really painful. But that's an aside. But I think to go back to sort of WIP, and one of the things that we were really successful at is creating supermarkets. So there were definitely times where we didn't know what market demand was. But let's say where we were making a one pack of vape and a two pack of vape, to stay on the vape pen pack for, or vape pens for a minute. I would make, you could make vape pens to bulk. Probably a better product to do this with would be soft gels. Soft gels have to be made in high quantities, the setup time of the machine, the way that it works. Say I made 100,000 capsules in, you know, 2 hours. Right.
Yeah.
So I then have capsules, but if I package them into 80 count jars, that WIP is dangerous to me because that 80 count package
limited to a skew.
It could take 2 months to sell that one. But if I left them as capsules, I can say I can go to an 80 count, a 40 count, a 20 count, or a sample pack with two. And that's really the manufacturing style for that product based on a lot of inputs. I mean, you know, look, if I could, you go back to batch size, if I could make a batch size small enough just to make my production, I would. But that, the equipment we had, the process we had, it didn't lend itself to that. I could have very easily said, I can't make them, you know, we make too many, but that's not what consumers want, right? Consumers want the product when they want it in the configurations that they want them. So I call that a supermarket, as does many of the lean. I think it's a phenomenal tool where you can plan with, and you can plan on how to bring it up and bring it down with the goal, really ultimately, that you don't need it anymore. So for pre-rolls, we had it for 2 months while demand was all, you know, increasing at a rapid rate for two SKUs of the same variety. And then once we settled in, we kind of knew exactly how many to produce of a five pack versus a two pack. And we went directly to packaging and we got rid of that supermarket. So,
it's a stopgap while you're figuring out the demand side, because you can't have demand driven production if you don't know your demand.
It's right? Continuous improvement. You know, I think that's the thing about lean. It's not just one point in time. I mean, our industry grows so fast. At Curio, we did the same project two or three times in the matter of 9 months. I think it was trimming, right? We started out, we it was our first cannabis company. We were growing some great product, but I don't want to say we knew how the best way to trim was, right? Was it wet trimming or dry trimming so we did a whole Kaizen improvement event around just trimming. And we said, this is the best process. But as demand increased, we said, well, that process doesn't work anymore for our business, right? What do we do? And we did it again. And then I think after I left, they did it again. I think it's just the idea, you know, you can't get settled into this is the way that it is. It's the only way that it is.
I like to add the word for now. That kind of resolves. This is the best process for now.
Exactly. And I would say, if you ask me, one sort of what is lean in like a phrase? I would say it's an extremely rigid system that allows you to be very flexible. And it's hard to wrap your mind around that, but you have to follow a process in order to know how to respond to market demand. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have any process, then you don't know what to plan. So that's really what my favorite sort of phrase is like, you got to follow a way of doing things and then improve upon that in order to be very flexible.
Yeah, I like that. I do love the flexibility and kind of the fact that lean can apply at any stage of a company. Like, it's not like you have to be at a certain place yet,
or even
it helps you get there.
A service company, right? If you're a Dutchie, you can imply lean. I mean, it's really not just manufacturing.
Yeah, no, not at all. And I would argue that cultivation can absolutely benefit from lean implementation as well.
Yeah.
So that's awesome. Let's talk a little bit more about going back to, I know you've got some brands that you're working on out here in Illinois, right?
We'll launch them. You know, one of the great things about my business today with Accelerant is, you know, we have partners in 11, soon to be 12 states. And I know that this really is about operational. So again, when people talk about asset light, I'll give the experience of a manufacturer. I've made, I don't know, 10 other companies' brands when I was on the manufacturer side. And asset light can be complicated because what you may see as creating your brand may drive a lot of cost into the product. And we definitely had licensed products where they were very expensive to make. And the licensed brand company said, we think this should sell for $30 because that's our brand. Well, if it costs me $20 to make it, I'm going to lose money if I have to give you 20% or 10% or whatever that number is.
Or if the local market isn't the same. Like we learned that with Steezy when we went into Michigan, the price we were charging in California didn't apply, right? So
it didn't apply. So the where I go with that is, if you are thinking about making a brand, how do you help your partner make it to market demand, right? And so what we took a look at is, we have equipment with great partners in many, many states. And we said, what products are they not making, right? Whether it's from California or whether it's from, you know, the East Coast for our California customers, and how do we help them make it, right? And that's not unlike, we had a partner of ours in Oregon that wanted to go to Michigan. And instead of building a cultivation center, they said, hey, Grant, we really just want to launch our pre-roll brand in Michigan. Do you have a partner there? And I said, absolutely. Let me connect you guys. I'm not going to get in the middle of your negotiation, but you know the products are going to look and feel and compact and smoke the same, right? So that's really, when it comes to our branded products, we're looking at things that either nobody's doing because the blinders are on, right? I can't do that. I have to do infused products, right? Yeah. This way. So we're looking at more, you know, frankly, I think, and I've had a lot of conversations at Benzinga, right? Like, weed's gotten really potent. And I think that's a big part of the market, but it's not the only part of the market. What I would call a super lightweight, you know, like smaller than a dog walker, right, is what I need.
One hitter quitter.
I've never had a super high tolerance and I'm okay with it.
You're a cheap date, dude. That's a good thing.
Exactly. I'm a cheap date. Yeah. So long story short is we're finding really complementary products to what we see on the market. And we're going to take the approach of asset backed, right? I'm going to bring not just our equipment, but, you know, expertise on how to make these products, really driving at helping our partners sell more product. And if our products are 5% or 10% of their sales, great. If they're 80%, awesome, but you know, I think it's probably going to be more towards the lower end. But it fills a gap that's just not made today. So that's really what we're doing. We're not doing any infused products at this point, because I think that you know, me as a consumer, to be frank, as much as it's efficient from a cost basis per milligram, I'm not interested often in spending twice as much when it doesn't really affect me very much. Like, it just knocks me out.
I don't
out.
Think anybody buys like that either, right? Like, who goes into a place and starts calculating their dollar per milligram? Nobody does that.
I don't know. I mean, it's not for me. So long story short, that's really what we're trying to do. As we build, I think these products will have other avenues. I don't know if we'll go down them, to be totally honest. I mean, if people love it and they love what we're doing, and we can expand into other categories. But, you know, my real desire is to have a pre-roll company, one that has consumer brands, one that has differentiated manufacturing, and one that has distribution. I think that that's not like an MSO, but like an MSO, right? Like, you know, I play just the category. I'm a pre-roll company. That's what I do.
No, that's really interesting. And it's like you're leading in with your brands, you're leading in with your equipment, but your brands are coming in. Is it like a kind of like a proof of concept then in many ways, or is it more like a gap filler? Or are you just focusing in one market specifically for your own brand? Or like, how do the brands or the brand of pre-rolls relate to your pre-roll manufacturing company in terms of, you know, market expansion and stuff?
Sure. Yeah, I think it's a good mix. I mean, the first thing is we really help companies make better product faster for their customers, which is, you know, our number one goal. And if we were to become distracted, I'd get rid of the brands and focus again back to what we are good at. I mean, we focused on getting profitable. I think it's in order for you to have a company that does anything, brands, not brands, doesn't matter. If you're not profitable or don't have a path to profitability, you have a limited window, right? When you're profitable, you can, you know, these brands were like, okay, guys, we got profitable. What's next, right? So we want to continue to support our companies. There are states like New York where, you know, our machines aren't at fully utilized numbers because the market hasn't developed yet. So how do I help fill up the capacity on a machine? So that's one element. And then the other element is, you know, I have been fortunate enough with this company to be in 11 states today, and you know, we're growing. How do we, what do we see? What do we not see? What are people doing and not doing? What are the people doing well? Not really as much focused on what our customers are doing or not doing in terms of the brands that we see, but the market as a whole. And then if we can direct that traffic back to our partners, it's better. You know, like I gave you the example of our Oregon customer that wanted to go to Michigan, another customer in Oregon. And this is really what we focus on. They took a machine doing about 80,000 units a month. And last month they did 280,000 units. So they were very focused on growing their brand and growing their operation. And we were there to help support. And that's the number one thing we do. But from our business, what having our own brands does is it allows us to capture a little bit more revenue and fill utilization on the machine. So those are the two things that just help us kind of maybe go from, you know, 13 cents to 15 cents or from 15 to 16, right, on average. And, you know, I like to call them the color copies, right? You have, if you look at us as Xerox, you know, you pay per sheet per copy, and then you pay for color copies. So different prices for toner and color ink.
Yeah, no, I like that a lot. And I know we were talking in a previous conversation about the economics behind using your machine, that it's interesting. And I'd love to touch on that, because I think that it sort of puts operators on their head a little bit with the way that they think about tolling cost, or sort of that cost plus model, right? Where most of the time they think, hey, you know, this is going to give me a smaller margin than I would get if I did it in-house. So why on earth, or if I did it the way I'm doing it now, so why on earth would I either outsource this or finance this thing or, you know, leverage another partner, which we're starting to see that unpack itself a little bit. But I know for a long time, it was like, why on earth will we use a partner to do something we can do cheaper? And I think it misses, you know, a big part of the story there.
I definitely agree. Look, I actually love in Michigan, there are some really great co-packers in Michigan, actually. And I think it proves the market for co-packers because in a hyper-competitive state, if you can make money co-packing, you know, it's a business to be had. I think the expectations of everybody, if you look at the food industry, right, like, you know, margins by, you know, stack in the supply chain, right? Yes, brands make a lot of margin. No, co-packers don't always make the most margin. But what does a co-packer do? In a lot of cases, they fill up their capacity with the low margin because it pays the fixed overhead and it increases the profitability of their brands or their overall company. So I really see that as back to our previous conversation about brands and why we're doing it. It's kind of a similar trend, but economically, you know, we have in the past really come into, well, it's cheaper for me to own a machine, right? As a customer. As opposed to our business model, which is I own the machines and I essentially lease it on a take or pay plus, you know, a unit fee, right? Like Xerox is whatever, $500 a month and 10 cents a copy, right?
Is Xerox even around anymore?
They are still around. They're a $10 billion company, I think, still. You know? But their business has shifted to digital. Ours, you know, I don't think people are going to smoke joints in the metaverse, but I could be wrong. People will, I think, always smoke joints and increasingly so. So,
yeah. So you guys do a base fee basically per machine and then you charge a unitized fee on top of that, basically. Is that how it works?
And you know, my point is in a lot of these conversations as of late is we've been fortunate. We've really found, we think, the technology suite that makes a difference and what we do. But we've replaced a lot of competitors' equipment, right? So
they already have this equipment in many ways.
They've had competitors' equipment, and I've probably replaced every brand of competitors' equipment in the field in one place or another. And I'm not saying that they're terrible. If you have great operators and great machinists and great consistency of product, there are definitely pieces of equipment that can work for you. But like in lean, right? Good inputs make good outputs, right? So, you know, if you have inconsistent inputs, it's a lot harder to use a machine. And if you buy it and it doesn't work, what's the ROI, right? Nobody has answered that question yet. However, that's really where our business comes in. You know, we are completely aligned for our customers to be successful. We've now crossed through. I know that you've been afflicted by consultants that are not good in the industry, that are subject matter experts. We've spent the time now with several who have worked with infused products because it's very popular, and their process performs exceptionally well on our equipment. I'm more than excited to introduce them to people, and you know, they're not that expensive, to be frank. And in certain circumstances, I've offered to pay for it, you know, because they're an existing partner of ours. And they said, hey, we want to go from regular flour to infused flour. And I said, look, you know, I'll pay for this one session because, you know, I want to see you guys make more joints. You know, you're never going to see a equipment sales company get into the material science of this type of product. It's just not going to happen. So that's how our business works. We own the CapEx. You know, think about month one going out of pocket for $200,000, $300,000, $500,000, $600,000. Some of our competitors' equipment's $1 million. For us, you know, you pay us a delivery fee and we install it. You got 30 days to tell me you don't like it. And if you don't like it during that 30 days, I pull the equipment out and send it to somebody else, you know, No questions asked.
It's interesting when you kind of explain it the way you did too, because at first glance, like, oh, this tolling cost. And I'm thinking of this from an operator's perspective, right? Like if I was approached by your company about it, my first inclination would be, again, going back to like, I'm already like on, you know, slim margins. Now I've got to pay this person like per unit. This sounds like a bad deal, but it's so interesting when you think about it, because you really are aligning your best interest. It is really a performance-based pay, because the only way you get paid more beyond the initial fee is the more they make. So you are incentivized to help them, whether it's increasing scale, whether it's widening their product offerings with new SKU types and all that stuff.
I find, by the way, many times people won't put their cost of financing into the fully loaded cost, right? And I'm like, well, you know, if you finance a piece of equipment at, you know, 13% over a few years and your monthly payments are, you know, whatever, $10,000, you know, it's the same to you, right? Now you might not get the depreciation or that, but what you get on the other side is, you know, an incredible support team. I mean, we literally have Slack. I can go on any piece of equipment and say to our team, hey guys, I like your help with twisting, and somebody's going to respond to you typically in less than 2 minutes and say, how can we help you? You know, in a traditional manufacturing environment, you'd go to your machine shop, you'd pull the maintenance tech out. He's probably working on something else, and you'd walk over to the machine and it'd spend 45 minutes trying to figure out what the deal was. And, oh, I got to go make a new part. So they walk back to the machine shop. And during that whole 4 hour long window, you made zero. Right.
Yeah.
I remote into the equipment. We fix the issues real time, because our business is real time. Your business is real time. And it's all about making sure that you are able to produce for your customers. That's all we care about.
I'm also wondering if there's even any benefit, going back to what you said about depreciation, given 280E, at least right now. I'd imagine, since you're paying taxes on that money anyway, that probably drastically impacts the what would be an advantage to buying something and writing it off over time. Is that right?
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that depends on how aggressive your tax accountant is, but I'm not here giving tax advice.
Yeah, fair. I mean, you have worked with a lot of operators at this point, in addition to being one yourself. What do you think is, like, if you had to kind of put into the top one or two things, what do you think is really the main differentiator between the operators that are seeing success and the ones that are just crap in the bed right now?
That's a great question. The first thing that comes to mind is focus. The second thing that comes to mind is intellectual honesty, right? Which I think can really be tied together in this circumstance of what I'm going to say. It's, in my opinion, unrealistic for a company to say we are going to be the best at everything. We are going to be the best retailer, the best distributor, the best vape manufacturer, the best flower grower, I just, in regular life, I think that's unrealistic. And so, you know, our partner out in Oregon that I like to give the example of with the growth, right? 80,000 to 280,000 units in just a few months. He said, he literally said this to one of my colleagues. He said, I want pre-rolls to be really successful, and I'm going to listen to your advice. Right. And we're like,
yeah,
that's awesome. Like, I knew right away when that information got relayed to me, I was like, this guy's going to kill it, right? I want to get him a machine, right? And he called us up, you know, a month or two ago. He said, I'm going to get to 500,000 joints. Can we start preparing for a second machine? I said, absolutely. Because, you know, you can see the numbers, right? We watch them all the time, right? You know, you go from 80 to 90 to 120 to 150. okay, now you're hitting 200,000 joints. Next month was 277. He's almost tapped out of capacity. Well, I don't want him to wait. So we actually started, he'll learn this from watching your podcast, that we started building his machine before he told us that he wanted it, because we saw it coming. But that's really how we really support
him. That's some real demand generated production right there.
It really is. But to answer your question, I think a lot of people focus on, like, we're going to be the best products company, but like not specific to a channel, right? Like, it's just too wide. Right.
The arrogance, right? It's they just can't lose, right? Just so easy. You just have a premium cannabis product. It's the best. It's the highest quality at the lowest. It reminds me of what the heck's that called? Prestige Worldwide. Every time I hear somebody say that, I'm just like, the biggest and the best.
I think there are a lot of people who can grow great flower. You know, and I think that that's a category that, you know, if a very few number of companies have created a very cult following, and some of those cult followings quality, I don't personally like, or it varies state to state too much. And I, you know, for me, I'm a consistency guy. Like if I'm drinking, I'm probably more like Tito's than I am like trying all these various different things, just because I know what to expect. And I know that's not for everybody. I think ultimately you'll see sort of commodity flower, very select premium flower, and then manufactured products where it's really segmented. I do think that pre-rolls are going to shift as we hope, certainly into larger consumption compared to other dosage forms.
Yeah, I mean, especially if people can kind of get the quality where it needs to be, right? I think that's always the complaint with folks that are more heavy smokers of flower and like to roll their own joints. Outside of liking to roll joints, is like there hasn't been a great way to lock in freshness. And then there's also the downside of some of the more unscrupulous operators adding trim and things like that, but that's more of a culture issue, I think, when it comes to the product issue. It's like someone needs to figure out that part of it. How do we maintain the same freshness as if it was in whole flower, at least, you know, for a month or two, right?
Yeah,
a reasonable consumption time frame. We can get to that. It's definitely more it's more convenient. I mean, can't say otherwise, right? It's, don't care how much you like rolling joints, sometimes you don't have time to do that. So
I actually do like rolling joints, but I've lost probably 3 or 5 grinders in my life and I don't know where they are. There's still some good weed in there if you find it, but I constantly misplace them because, you know, I take them to a friend's house or, you know, so I just buy joints now.
Are you trying to roll one out in the wind? That's the worst, man.
Yeah, I take it to a concert, you know, do the whole grinder, and then what do I do with the grinder, you know?
Yeah,
like, just hold it.
Is someone else's tool now?
Yeah.
Oh man. So I think that I've been hearing a lot of that pattern, right, of people that are focusing on one thing, and as you're talking about it, I'm thinking of some of the best brands out there that kind of have that cult following. One that comes to mind immediately is like 710 Labs, right? And what do they do everything? No, like they do relatively wide variety of stuff now, but their main like meat and potatoes is obviously that, you know, solventless extraction, right? Like that is what they do. And even all the flower that they grow and everything around that is with that in mind, right?
Well, that's exactly it. You know, there's a very small number of growers that I really trust in this industry. And they'll say to me, you know, if you ask me to design a cultivation center for pure biomass, it's going to look a lot different than just pure A-grade flower, which is different than, you know, if you were asking it for fiber, right? The styles of grow, the physical setup. So, you know, you're exactly right. I mean, if you're geared towards mechanical extraction, that's all you're doing. I mean, does it matter what the flower looks like? Not really, right?
No, you're outside of the trichome structure.
Yeah. Maybe you like Calyx. Maybe you like the Foxtails because it's more surface area. I mean, I don't really know. It's not my game, but like.
No, 100%, right? It's like you're not selling the flower. You're not selling the product. And even with biomass, you know, I would argue, assuming we're talking about like distillate biomass, I would say it's a no-brainer. You want an outdoor farm. Don't care where you're at. Doesn't matter if it gets moldy. It's going to go through a kill step anyway, right? You just want the cheapest per pound possible to get the biggest yields you can and flavor, and none of that stuff matters, right? And so then you go to the farmers that are growing like 20 different strains and they're sending it to distillate, and it's like, why don't you just pick, you know, one early finisher, one middle finisher, and one late finisher, and that's the only criteria outside of the yield, you know what I mean, and like just run those and have and have an early harvest, a mid harvest, and late harvest. Like, what other? There's no flavor profiles that you're getting in this stuff. Like, you're just complicating it, which I think goes back to the lean in cultivation.
100%. Right? It's ironic you bring up the mold piece. You know, obviously now I think there's a lot of there's some states that are more. There's been aspergillus testing, I think, in Oregon or Washington that it's really, really taken off. One of the molds that's prevalent in cannabis, Botrytis, is. I mean, aside from being everywhere, is also called noble mold in the winemaking industry, you know? So it, you know, to your point, maybe it makes it better. I mean, I'm not saying it does, like, total disclaimer, but, you know, it's just, I think you're right. I think especially for distillate, a company, you brought up 710 Labs. I think Wana executed perfectly on being a gummy company. I think Wild's doing it right now. I think they're just, you know, we make gummies, great gummies, different gummies, fast acting, slow acting, sleep. And yeah, they've dabbled into vapes and they've dabbled into other areas, but it's only after they really nailed doing one thing.
And as a compliment to that thing, not like, hey, we're now a vape company.
Yeah, exactly.
And just so I don't get any hate from the cultivators out there, obviously, depending on when you get mold, that could absolutely affect the plants. But I think when you're harvesting, worrying too much about some mold contamination.
We're not advocating for mold. We don't like mold.
And mycotoxins, not talking about mycotoxins either.
Yeah.
Relax on that.
Yeah, I mean, like, I totally agree. And again, I mean, that's one of the things from the food industry. I mean... you know, organic is really hyper-regulated. What do people consider to be acceptable versus not acceptable? Whether it's a lot of the spice industry is irradiated. And trust me, you want that in that industry. And then a lot of spices are steam sterilized. Steam sterilization is, can be finicky because of mold. If you don't have a perfectly dry steam, you can literally create mold. And so that really is...
What is dry steam, out of curiosity? Because I'm trying to understand what that even is.
Yeah, I mean, I forget the exact moisture content that it can have, but it's essentially so low in the water molecule, you know, water percentage, that it's considered to be a dry steam, and it's incredibly low. It's essentially really hot air. You know, but those systems, I think a lot of stuff from food should come into cannabis, but frankly, cannabis doesn't have the scale. I mean, when you think of milling, right? I mean, we sell a grinder, and it's can fit on my tabletop. The grinders that we used in the herbs and spices industry were, you know, the size of two cars, right? I mean, it's I think that's the challenge of innovation in cannabis, is it's still at this very odd state of scale that frankly gives companies like mine opportunity to innovate, but it's also limiting in cost reduction, right? Like, you know, look, if you could jar a bag of weed in, you know, 25 a second, your cost basis to the consumer is going to be less than if you have someone who packages, you know, 10 a minute, you know, by hand, right?
Yeah, but only when you have the demand, otherwise your machine's working at 2% capacity, and it's like you're not really saving.
Yeah, much. And I do think that our business model can help companies get there. I mean, we generally will save customers between 30% and 70% of labor on our fee, right? Depending on what they're making and how they're making it, but the 70% ones, I should charge more. I should charge based on savings, but you know, I'd rather just have a fee and they can manage their business. But that's really, I think, where the industry, you know, should focus is, and I think it has. I mean, you know, there's definitely technology that has made its way into cannabis that hasn't been in it for the last 10 years, but maybe is entering. And I think it always enters with a level of skepticism. But I really do think that that's really where we're going to get a lot of cannabis innovation from is the food industry.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And I think we already have in many respects, like you said, but I also think that there's a lot of like natural mistrust of some of these things that we use in other industries, but they kind of see it as, you know, taking away from the natural state of the plant. So it'll be interesting to see if we lean into that or whether the, you know, market as a whole kind of accepts and adopts some of those standard practices elsewhere.
Yeah, I agree.
Why don't we move into my standard four questions I like to ask everybody at the end of the interview here. First question is, what is your favorite business book?
My favorite business book is I'm trying to remember the name of it right now. It's sitting on the counter over here. It's by Art Byrne. I think it's called Lean Turnaround. Really phenomenal book. My favorite quote that from a book that is not that book is you can have positive airspeed and negative ground speed. So I'll find the book, I'll send you the quote, but I think that applies to a lot of cannabis businesses where you have positive airspeed and negative ground speed. And so you're moving backwards and don't realize it.
Yeah, it's kind of that relationship between that top line obsession and then
and the earth moving in completely opposite direction.
Yeah. And their profits moving in a completely opposite direction. what's your favorite cultivar?
My favorite cultivar is probably I would say we used to grow this variety Golden Strawberry. I just think it grew really well. I thought it was really attractive plant. For me, you know, when we were in college, we had no idea what we were buying. It was good weed or bad weed. And I liked the good stuff and I didn't like the bad stuff. So an imprecise answer, but that's what it is.
That's funny because that's mostly my answer too, because my favorite weed was in high school and I have no idea what it was. You know, yeah. I mean, we thought we knew what it was, but we had no way of verifying. Yeah. So
they didn't tell us in our, I'm not going to say where I got it from, but you know, we lived in a big house and we had a lot of guys that lived there and someone would always inevitably be that guy. And we'd go, hey, you know, can I get a dime bag or can I get a quarter or whatever? He's like, here you go. I don't even think he ever told me what it was. He's just like, here it is. Yeah, been pre-vetted. Weird. It's good stuff. And you're like, great. Exactly.
What are your interests and hobbies outside of cannabis?
My interests, I have a very old dog now, so I walk him like probably 12 times a day because he's just getting old. And I just really enjoy cooking, enjoy hanging around family, and you know, going on walks with my wife around wherever we are, which right now is Chicago, but you know, used to be Miami.
Better get those walks in while you still can.
I know, it's getting a little cold.
You got some dark clouds in the sky. What's your main dish that you can cook? If you had to pick one.
Ooh, good question. Last week we made some ratatouille. It was pretty good. Oh, you know, nice. Anybody can cook. But if we don't have anything in the house, I make a really good pasta dish. Really simple. But you know, I'll cook anything.
Yeah, you kind of have to when you're grown up as a bachelor, right? You can either take it in the way of
making some disgusting ramen and tuna fish can or something like that, or you can learn how to actually spice.
I used to cheat a little bit. I'll admit this now. I used to cheat a little bit because I worked at a spice company. So, we had, jerk chicken seasoning and chimichurri seasoning always just ready to go. And I'd be like, hey, I take some of that with me home. And that dinner that night was exceptional.
See, that's the ticket that people don't realize is that it's all about the spices, right? And you can have two sets of spices too. And one can be more fresh and better quality. And then you can have one that's way worse. And the difference will be astronomical. I always used to wonder when my dad's food tasted 1,000 times better than mine. And it was because I was in college buying like the cheapest, shittiest spices that probably already expired, to be honest with you. And my dad, all my dad's stuff was either homegrown or Penzies or, whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. For another time, the product development life cycle of Boar's Head or anything in that world, right, is very interesting on who owns the flavor. And it's that part of the industry is very interesting on how it gets done.
A lot of patents, I'd imagine.
Not a lot of patents, a lot of trade secrets, which is another side of the world. And then the spice companies end up actually owning the formula. And for most companies, not all, but that becomes a switching cost risk when you if you're an operator. And then, look. Yeah,
that's a great point.
It's again, for another time, another product dev podcast.
There we go. Where can folks connect with you, learn more about your brands and your equipment business, et cetera?
Brands will be launching probably really in earnest Q1. This quarter is all about development, all about just getting the I's dotted, T's crossed, supply chain organized.
You're not just throwing stuff out there without any planning at all. That's crazy.
Yeah, crazy. You can connect with me on LinkedIn. I'm usually pretty active. Our website's accelerantmanufacturing.com we're in 11 states. I encourage you to buy pre-rolled joints anywhere, increase the demand anywhere. You'll know when you buy it from our partners, it's got the signature finish on it. So
very good. I like that call to action. Mm-hmm. Thanks so much, Grant. Appreciate your time, bud.
Thank you.
And that wraps up today's show. I hope you enjoyed it. For additional information on the episode and links to Grant's website and social media, please check out the show notes at podcast.diamondminers.co/episode-10. While you're there, be sure to sign up for the DMC newsletter so you can have industry insights from yours truly delivered directly to your email inbox. As always, thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.
You've been listening to the Diamond Miners Podcast with Benjamin Ballinger. If you found this podcast valuable, please take a minute to give the show a 5-star review, and don't forget to subscribe for more episodes just like this one. You can also follow DMC on Twitter and LinkedIn at Diamond Miners CO, or connect directly with me on LinkedIn at linkedin.com/in/VR Ballinger.